Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, your host. With every step we take, we're generating personal data, which is captured and sold, often without our knowledge. Those data are then used to predict or to influence the choices we make. Joining us to discuss this modern-day reality is Shoshana Zuboff. She's professor emerita at Harvard Business School, and she's the author of a new book entitled Surveillance Capitalism. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio and the Aspen Institute. This broadcast is made possible each week with the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. This program is moderated by Jim Fruchterman. He's founder and CEO of Tech Matters. And now to Jim and Shoshana Zuboff.
Welcome, Dr. Zuboff. And
Thank you, Jim.
The title of your book crystallizes a lot of the fears that people have that maybe not all is right in Silicon Valley. Could you expand on what you mean by surveillance capitalism?
What is surveillance capitalism? Indeed. Let's talk about that for a moment, and then the rest of what we're going to discuss tonight, I think, will make a bit more sense. So, people have long observed in the history of capitalism the way that it evolves. And the idea is that it evolves by taking things that live outside the market dynamic and bringing them into the market. You know the term commodities, bringing them into the market to turn them into commodities that can be sold and purchased. So, famously, industrial capitalism claimed claimed nature for the market dynamic, bringing it into the market dynamic to be reborn as land or real estate that could be sold and purchased. It claimed work for the market dynamic, the kinds of activities that people did in their homes, in their cottages, in their gardens, in their fields, bringing that into the market to be reborn as labor that could be sold and purchased. Well, surveillance capitalism diverges from many aspects of the history of capitalism, but in this way, it actually emulates this earlier pattern, but with an unexpected and even perhaps we might call it a dark twist. In this case, surveillance capitalism claims private human experience for the market dynamic. And in claiming private human experience, it treats it as a free source of raw material to be translated into behavioral data. These behavioral data are then shipped through pipelines, as it were, into a new kind of manufacturing process. This manufacturing process is characterized by something that Jim is an expert in, what we call today artificial intelligence, machine learning, machine intelligence. And with that combination of these flows of behavioral data and machine intelligence, what comes out the other end are predictions. Predictions of human behavior. And I call these prediction products. These products are then sold in a new kind of marketplace, a marketplace that trades exclusively in, if you will, behavioral futures, kind of like pork bellies, behavioral futures. Now, what I've just described to you may sound very science fiction-y.
How does it work?
But indeed, when you think about the online targeted advertising and how that works, what I've just described is really a fitting depiction of that whole process. Because in the game of online targeted advertising, for example, the prediction products, the predictions of future behavior, were really predictions of what they call click-through rates, of who's likely to click through on an ad and through the pages and so on to make that advertiser money. And what are the online advertisers actually buying? What they're buying are these little bets on what future behavior is going to be. Indeed, this whole logic was first discovered, invented, elaborated at Google back in the early 2000s in the heat of financial emergency of the dot-com bust. And when Google proposed this new logic to its advertisers, mm-hmm. they were very reluctant to accept it because now here was a prediction product coming out of a black box. And the idea for the advertisers was, you know, we're not going to tell you what's in the black box. That's our stuff. Right. But if you just follow the advice of this computational product coming out of the black box, you will make a lot of money. And eventually they decided to accept this. And, of course, the rest is history.
Indeed. And, of course, they had refused to do advertising in the early days. So somehow their economic imperative overcame their principles against doing advertising.
Well said, Jim, indeed. Because the Google founders and indeed the seven people who then worked inside Google who were relegated to the advertising function, they all pretty much detested advertising. They said it would disfigure the web and they said it would disfigure the search engine. Mm. And it did. But as you pointed out, in the heat of emergency, the idea of actually going bankrupt, investors were threatening to pull out their money, and that trumped all other concerns at that point. So what we know about the success of this economic logic implemented at Google secretly between 2000-2001 and 2004 when it IPO'd and the world first got a look at this new logic, we know that during those years, Google's revenue line increased by 3,590%. So there's some pretty good evidence of the power and the profitability of an unprecedented economic logic, again, based on the unilateral claiming of private human experience. And may I
please
complete my answer,
please,
with one more sentence-ish?
Yeah.
You're so kind. So you may ask, well, why call it surveillance capitalism? What's the surveillance got to do with it? And what the surveillance has to do with it is that it's not easy to unilaterally claim and take private human experience. You know, we are individuals who have a sense of privacy, have a sense of personal boundaries, who want a say in how those boundaries operate. And if those boundaries are to be breached, then we want to be the ones who decide. We want those decision rights. And so it was early on understood quite quickly that if we're going to take private human experience as the raw material for behavioral data, we have to do it secretly. And early on, in the descriptions of the early patents and so forth, the scientists were quite explicit about the fact and even kind of celebrating the sophistication of the methods they were developing, that they could find and capture personal information without the, quote, user's knowledge, and that they could find and capture various different points of user information that was lying around the web and put it together and make inferences about users that was stuff that these users never intended to disclose. So this one-way mirror was there from the start. And indeed, the social relations of the one-way mirror were essential to the financial achievement.
But that's not the story that Silicon Valley told everybody, right? They told a story of human utility. We're finding things better for you. We're routing you better. You're finding the right products. So how did that goal of human utility, making human beings more powerful, how did that go from trying to do, say, good on purpose to, let's say, evil by accident? How did that come to pass?
Well, I would like to not say, I'm not going to use the word evil.
Okay.
For a very specific reason.
Yes.
I've described the bare bones of an economic logic. And inside this economic logic, over the years that I have studied it, what I understand is that there are imperatives that develop in the competitive intensity of this economic logic. Economic imperatives emerge. These imperatives compel certain kinds of action. And so what we have now are corporations and many, many people inside these corporations who are compelled to act in order to fulfill the requirements of these economic imperatives.
Okay.
So to me, it's very important to distinguish. We're not talking about evil people. We're talking about people who have now who have now committed themselves to a machine, if you will, to a logic, which compels certain kinds of decisions, certain kinds of actions, certain kinds of operations. These operations have some fairly dire consequences for things that we care a whole lot about, like human freedom and democracy and so forth. And I know we're going to get to that down the line.
Yeah. Well, I think, as you know, in the startup ecosystem, if you wanted to raise venture capital, the whole thing was not about what you were going to do. It's like, how many eyeballs were you going to capture? It was so everyone got the message, if you want to get funded, tell us how you're going to capture a whole bunch of information about human beings, people.
Yes.
So.
Yes, indeed. So that's a good segue into talking about the economic imperatives.
Thank you.
Would that be a good place to go?
I want to hear how this economic imperative leads to some of these not so great outcomes.
Yeah. Okay. So. This was a many year labor, sometimes of love, sometimes of my own compulsion, and over this time, I began to discern, you know, what these economic imperatives are and how they work. And clearly, when surveillance capitalism first emerged, it emerged primarily in the online world, in the virtual world, around these activities of search and browse and so forth. And early on, it was understood that if we're going to get enough behavioral data to really feed the machines in order to get good predictions, then we need a lot of data. Jim, we need a lot of data. You know that. The machines.
It's an omnivorous machine.
The machines are omnivorous. And so the idea here is that we want predictions that approach certainty, right? The best predictions are almost as good as observations. So ideally, you want your predictions to be on a trajectory towards certainty. And if we're going to do that, we want data to be on a trajectory toward totality. The more data, the more totalistic the data, the more we're going to achieve certainty. All right, so that introduces imperative number one. I call it the extraction imperative. We need to take everything, and that's what you're mentioning there, Jim. We need to take as much as we can possibly take, and this requires economies of scale. Volume, data at volume. And by economies, of course, I mean, the machines do it. So these are automated systems that, you know, again, at the beginning, as you search, as you browse, automated systems that are tapping into your experience, pulling it in, and converting it into data that can be read by machines. So we begin with extraction and economies of scale, a lot of data. But then, you know, the competitive intensity continues to build. And as that intensity builds, it becomes clear that, yeah, we need a lot of data, but we also need different qualities of data. We need varieties of data. We need scale, but we also need scope. And to get scope, you remember when folks first started talking about the mobility revolution, right? This is get up out of your chair, leave your desktop, leave your laptop, get out the door. And what are you taking out the door with you? Your phone, your smartphone. So now this is to get out the door, and we begin to get scope, qualities, new qualities, differentiated forms of data as we get out the door. We get where you're going and what you're doing and who you're doing it with and what you're saying and how you're walking and how you look and what you're buying and what you're eating. And eventually we get, with facial recognition, you know, we get the 1,000 muscles in your face that help us predict your emotional state. And then we get not only where you're walking, but how you're walking, and if you're slumped over or if you're standing up straight, your gait, your posture. When we listen to your voice, we get the cadence and the velocity and the decibel levels and so forth. So we're getting all of these rich data now, both as you range out and about into the world, but also down into the depths of yourself, your body, your emotions, your all the things that you're signaling
do
with your...
Do they need all of that to route us from point A to point B?
Well, let's say, do they need all of that? Okay, so here's the point.
Okay.
Here's the point. Mm-hmm. You're touching on the notion of behavioral surplus here. Mm-hmm. Because early on, the distinction was, okay, there's a whole lot of these data that we can use for improving our products and services. That's what we all wanted in the first place, wasn't it? You know, like, make the search engine better and give us translation functions and, you know, allow it to work more faster, more effectively, and so forth. So there's a lot of data that was and is used to improve products and services, right. And that's cool. But then it was discovered that from these data, one can draw signals, signals. Sometimes this is called metadata, but signals that have tremendous predictive value. So let me give you an example. When we talk about, for example, the data that we put on Facebook, so we write posts, we write messages, we give data in our talking to our friends and our family and other people on Facebook, we provide data, we put data on the Facebook platform. But what's really predictive about the data that we provide is not so much what we say, but how we say it. For example, you've written some sentences in your post. Are the sentences long and complex, or are they short and simple? Do you use bullet points? Do you use exclamation points? Do you use question marks? If you make plans to see your friends this evening, your friends and family, do you say, I'll see you later? Or do you say, I'll see you at 7:45? If you post photos, it's not just the photos who you post photos of. It's that you post photos. It's the saturation level and the colors of the photos that you post. In your voice, for example, it's not just what you say, but it's the intensity of your voice. It's the velocity of your speech. So you're getting the picture here. So it's extracting these qualities of data that really go beyond what they need for service and product
and
improvement.
And this allows them to be somewhat disingenuous and say, we don't sell your data.
We don't sell your personal data. Exactly. What they're selling is the data that is more than, I mean, what they're collecting mm-hmm. for their predictions is the data that is more than what is actually needed for product and service improvement.
They sell the gold instead of the ore.
Indeed.
Yeah.
So these data are what I call the surplus, the behavioral surplus. And it's in these behavioral surplus data stores that we find the great predictive qualities. And of course, if you fast forward a little bit, may I just to an example that might put a little bit of meat on these
bones?
That
would be great, because I think people are getting the idea that there's something wrong here, but they're getting the feelings of what the outline is, so.
Okay. So it's like, it was discovered, for example, as folks were collecting these behavioral surplus data, it was discovered that you could predict a person's personality traits with behavioral surplus. And this, there's a lot of research on this. Just it didn't just come from the companies.
Yeah.
But, you know, scholars were researching this, and scholars discovered that with things like, you know, your exclamation points and the saturation levels of your photos and some of the things I've just mentioned to you, they could predict, as well as human scorers, where you fit on this five-factor personality model that psychologists use to talk about personality. I'm going to say personality with finger quotes because I actually, you know, I'm a studied social psychology as a PhD, and I believe that personality is something far more complex and deep and profound than five-factor personality model. But five-factor personality model lends itself to what? Automation.
Yeah.
Automated scoring, economies of scale. So, so anyway, with behavioral surplus, you can predict where people are on these personality models. Now, is this beginning to sound familiar to you? Because there was a little-known company that hailed from Cambridge, England, right? And we're about to celebrate the one-year anniversary of Chris Wiley's whistleblowing activities that alerted the world to what Cambridge Analytica was up to and its manipulations of the electorate, both in our country, in the UK, and in many other countries, at least 15 that I've looked into. What did they do? They took exactly these methodologies and mechanisms. They had a guy who got 87 million people's worth of data from Facebook. They tracked it onto the five-factor personality model. They got psychographic data on all these millions of people. And with those psychographic data, they figured it out that they could create little trigger messages that would, as Chris Wiley put it, stir up the inner demons of these folks because they understood so much about their personalities. Right? So what they did was they took methods and mechanisms that had become sort of routine, day in the life, ho-hum, please pass the salt, right? The everyday methodologies of any self-respecting surveillance capitalist. And they just pivoted them slightly from commercial outcomes. Mm-hmm. Let's direct you in a way where it's going to help us make money, to political outcomes. Let's direct you in a way where it's going to produce the elections that we want for the people who have bought the expertise and the data to make this kind of intervention possible.
So the challenge here then is that we've moved beyond selling products or making products that are better from a commercial standpoint to actually trying to influence the behavior of human beings to do something different in the political sphere. So this could be a real instrument of social control in the wrong hands.
All right, so you've given me the perfect segue once again.
Okay.
I've discovered the world's best moderator. Now you have to travel with me everywhere I go.
I'll follow you anywhere.
All right, so I began to describe the economic imperatives to you. And we got through extraction and scale, and then we started talking about scope. I mentioned to you that we see these imperatives emerging as the competitive intensity keeps heating up. And in order to explain, little bracket here, in order to explain what I mean by competitive intensity, I should say that while surveillance capitalism originated in Google, it didn't just stay in Google. You know that, right? So it quickly migrated to Facebook. It migrated to Facebook with Sheryl Sandberg, who was an early executive at Google, was very much part of the discovery and elaboration of surveillance capitalism. And she was the one hired by Mark Zuckerberg to bring this advertising know-how, which we now understand as surveillance capitalism, to Facebook, which she did very, very effectively. So then we had a duopoly. But once the success of this logic was out of the bag, and I know that you've seen this in Silicon Valley, Jim, this logic quickly became the default model in the tech sector in Silicon Valley, because what they had discovered was sort of the as the crow flies fast track to monetization.
Yeah, if you weren't doing it, you were behind.
Now, if you had done, you know how that phrase, creative destruction, is a beloved phrase
move
in Silicon Valley?
Things. Yes.
Creative destruction. Well, you may or may not know that that phrase comes from the renowned Harvard economist Joseph Schumpeter. He had sort of biological model, and he wrote about creative destruction. It's true. But he wrote about creative destruction as a tiny little piece of a much larger theory. And his theory was that capitalism evolves, mm-hmm. number one. So it's like kind of like biology. It evolves like organisms. And it evolves as a result of a creative response to a new situation. An unfortunate consequence of a creative response is that there's sometimes some creative destruction. But creative response was really the big deal. And in the creative response, he said, this is years, decades, sometimes even centuries of scrupulous institution building to really create the new way of doing business, the new market form, the new qualities of capitalism that will truly meet the needs of populations, people, and lift the standard of living for all people. This is what Schumpeter was really about. Instead, what we've just talked about, they figured out that as the crow flies, there was no time for years, decades, heaven forbid, a century, to really figure this thing out. So this is how competitive intensity is heating up, because everybody now had to rise to this standard. Mm-hmm. And what we have come to see, Jim, and I know you're aware of this, is that surveillance capitalism has now moved far beyond the tech sector. We can no longer just talk about the tech sector here. Mm-hmm. It has traveled across the normal economy. Yep. So when we're talking about insurance, we're talking about finance, we're talking about retail, we're talking about healthcare, we're talking about the education sector, and now we'll go full circle. Ford Motor Company, right? Where mass production was born, where all about the century of consumption and middle-class employment. Now the CEO of Ford Motor says, you know what? It's really getting hard to make any money selling cars. And it doesn't look like it's going to get any better. We want to make money with data. And all of a sudden, the idea is, we've got 100 million people driving around in Ford cars. So let's just start to stream data from the personal experience of all these folks. And then we're going to be able to have behavioral data, and we're going to be able to make predictions, and we're going to be able to have markets, and we're going to compete with the margins of the likes of Google and Facebook.
We've been hearing from Shoshana Zuboff on what she has dubbed surveillance capitalism. It describes the new market of collecting and selling our personal data. After the break, join us for the second half of the conversation. You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, your host. We're hearing from Shoshana Zuboff. She's professor emerita at Harvard's Business School, and she's the author of a new book entitled Surveillance Capitalism. Moderating the program is Jim Fruchterman. He's founder and CEO of Tech Matters. To hear this program or any other World Affairs program, you can download our podcasts on our iTunes channel or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs. That's one word. And now back to our program.
And so much of the rhetoric is, you know, from the tech industry is this is just capitalism. This is just the way it works. If you want to make money, we make money off of data now. And this is not different in kind than past kinds of capitalism. But I think you believe this is different in kind because we haven't had some of this norming. And it sounds like you also think that many of these companies have hidden what they're doing from us. And this is pretty famous in Silicon Valley, right? I mean, it might be illegal, it might be cutting a corner, but by the time anyone figures out, we'll be so wealthy at such scale, whatever fines we pay, whatever price we pay is worth it.
Absolutely.
So is that going on in this new industry? And how?
Okay. Okay, well, let's talk about that. All right. So with this competitive intensity increasing, a new discovery was made, and it's still this discovery process, I would say, is still in play right now. And this discovery was, holy smokes, the very best predictive data, the very best source of predictive data comes from, yeah, we need scale and yeah, we need scope, but it really comes from intervening in people's behavior. Actually intervening
A-B testing.
In the state of play.
Yeah.
And gently tuning, and sometimes not so gently, but we could talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
Tuning, herding, modifying behavior in the direction of the commercial outcomes we seek. Mm-hmm. All right, so you put your finger right on the right button there. This began with something that seemed totally banal.
Mm-hmm.
A-B testing. You all know what that is, A-B testing, the idea that, okay, you're looking at one web page for ice cream, and you're looking at what should be the same web page for ice cream, but there's subtle differences in the web page. And then they can see how you interact with it, and they know if your subtle difference is going to be more lucrative than your subtle difference, and on it goes. And basically, web pages are always always have some of this kind of testing going
on. Every day, tens of thousands of
every
tests
day.
By every major
thousands
company.
And thousands.
Yes.
Okay. But it moves on from there. So testing begins to get serious. For example, some of you may have read about what Facebook called its massive scale contagion experiments. So these massive scale contagion experiments, 2012, 2013. 2012, the first one was published in an academic journal. Mm-hmm. I know you remember this, Jim.
Yes.
And the idea here was subtle manipulations, subliminal cues in your Facebook pages that would that where they were trying to see if they could use subliminal cues in the online milieu to get you to go and vote in the 2012 midterm elections. Could they use subtle cues in the online milieu to change real world behavior, i.e. folks who might not have voted went and did vote? And of course, lo and behold, they discovered that the answer was yes. They could, and they did. And when they wrote it up, they celebrated the fact, writing this up in a scholarly journal, they celebrated the fact that, A, we now know that we can use online cues to change real-world behavior. Right. That was number one. Right. And number two, yippee, we can do this in a way that completely bypasses people's awareness. You never knew that we were there. And this gets us to a very, very big point about that one-way mirror I mentioned, mm-hmm. that all of the big money that we're making, all the surveillance mm-hmm. capital that's being accumulated, a lot of that money and expertise goes into designing these systems in a way that they are engineered for our ignorance. Mm-hmm. We must be ignorant of what's going on behind the veil, because honestly, and all the research that exists out there, when we are told about it, when we find out about it, the reaction is, ugh, I don't want that. How do I protect myself from that? All right, so that leads on to another set of complicated questions that I'm not going to answer right now. But the point is, getting back to, is this merely capitalism? Mm-hmm. Okay. So what we see with these, now we have economies of scale, economies of scope, and economies of action. Data scientists call this the shift from monitoring to actuation. Mm-hmm. One data scientist explained this situation to me. He said, we're getting very good at knowing how to engineer the music, and then we let the music make them dance. That's how he described it to me. The shift from monitoring to actuating human behavior. All right, so I write about this as what we've created now is literally a global means of behavioral modification at scale. That means automated means embedded in the digital architecture, from our laptops to our phones to the digital surround that increasingly follows us all through our daily lives, mm-hmm. Is repurposed as a means of behavioral modification. Do we have time to talk about Pokemon Go in this respect?
Go right ahead, and then I want to move to, could this actually be socially beneficial and under what circumstances? But let's have an example so people know how far this goes in the real world, and then move to, what do we do with this new monster we've created?
All right, friends. So, Pokemon Go is another population-scale experiment in a global means of behavioral modification. And we thought it was a game. Mm-hmm. It turned out it was a game, and perhaps I should use the present tense, it is a game within a game. So we thought that Pokemon Go was monetized. Oh, and let me just preface by saying, mm-hmm. in case you don't know it, Pokemon Go was incubated in Google. It was developed and managed by a man named John Hankey, who before that was a key person in Google Maps. He ran Street View. But before that, he was a key person in Google Earth. But before that, he was the person who invented Keyhole, which is a company invested in by the CIA. Ultimately, Google bought it, brought it into Google, and named it Google Earth.
Anyway. Pokemon Go. So how does this actually... Why are people doing more than just playing a game?
We thought that the whole game was going to be monetized by people buying little doodads for their Pokemon creatures and little game tokens and so forth.
Standard.
Eventually, what came out was that the way that Pokemon Go was being monetized was that it had constituted its own behavioral futures markets. So now, in your city, there were bars and pizzerias and restaurants and other kinds of service establishments, mm-hmm. McDonald's franchises, who were paying Pokemon Go for footfall. And Pokemon Go would run the game so that a certain number of people were herded to these paying customers so that they could bring their real bodies with their real feet to these real places and spend real money. Now, what does this remind you of? It must remind you of something that we've just talked about. Because it's exactly the same structure as online targeted advertising, isn't it? Mm-hmm. We saw there the piece of future behavior was the click-through, and we've got these business customers interested in our future behavior mm-hmm. paying for click-through rates. Well, now click-through is footfall. We've gone from walking with our fingers to walking with our feet, right? And instead of online advertisers, it's real-world establishments paying to get our feet into their space.
So I'm starting to get questions from the audience, and I think the question that has come through a couple different ways is, getting people to vote is in some ways a civic good. So you could imagine this sneaky technology being used to advance social goods, just as it's being used to maybe suppress voters from another angle. So how does society engage with the fact that there's this incredible experiment being run on all of us all of the time right now? And how do we influence it to do more good and less things that are either benign or neutral or possibly negative from an ethical or for a societal standpoint?
Beware your first impressions, friends. Beware your first impressions. When we talk about the power to modify our behavior at scale, we are talking about a kind of power that has never existed before. This is an unprecedented form of power. This is a power that works through the means of the digital milieu, mm-hmm. through this vast digital surround, outside of our awareness, without our permission, without our knowledge, and therefore without our consent, without our right of combat, without our choice. We are not involved here. We are pawns that are being pushed around for the purposes of others' gain. And we saw how that translated into Cambridge Analytica, mm-hmm. and it was a nightmare. So we have to ask ourselves, what is this form of power, friends? Because this has never existed before, just as the digital surround has never existed before. These methods and mechanisms have never existed before. I felt the need to name this kind of power. We often confuse it with totalitarianism, and I believe that has set us back from actually understanding it. Totalitarianism is about violence and terror. Totalitarianism wants to rebuild you from the inside out. That was the whole point of 1984, the engineering of the soul. This new form of power really does not give a toss about you. It does not care what you believe. It does not care how you feel. It does not care where you're going or what you're doing or what you're reading. It only cares that you are going and doing and reading and feeling and talking and thinking and saying in ways that it can access as raw material, turn into behavioral data, and use as predictions for its marketplace. Mm-hmm. So it literally takes on the attitude of the behaviorist experimenter who really doesn't care a lot about the rat. It just wants to know that it can measure the rat and train the rat to go from A to B. And in fact, when you go back to radical behaviorism, you know, what the behaviorists, like my old professor B.F. Skinner, say is there is no inside, you know, there is no consciousness, there are no feelings, there are no emotions, there's only measurable behavior. And this new kind of power is only interested in that measurable behavior. I call it instrumentarian power, mm-hmm. Jim, mm-hmm. because for two reasons. One is it works through the medium of all of the digital instrumentation. It can't work by hand because that's not economies. It has to work economies of scale to modify behavior. And the idea here now, it's not only automating the way it gets information about us, mm-hmm. it's actually automating us. So that's number one. And number two is, I call it instrumentarian power because it turns us into instruments of others' gain. Okay. It's an instrumental relationship with its societies, with its population, with us as individuals. And so for these reasons, I call it instrumentarian power.
Okay, so wrap up that thought, and then I want to follow the next step
okay,
to some more questions here. So
what I want to say to you is that the harm here is that these operations cannot function effectively unless they intervene on the very fundamental experiences that we call human autonomy, unless they circumvent our decision rights, which requires bypassing our awareness. Self-determination is the enemy of automated behavioral modification, which is itself becoming de rigueur for these operations. Mm-hmm. And by the way, Jim, mm-hmm. Pokemon Go was a population scale experiment, but that experiment is very quickly being translated into a much more flesh and blood, real life consequences mm-hmm. Kind of operation that is called the smart city. Google likes to call it the Google city. And right now, the citizens of Toronto are facing off against Google in the incarnate Sidewalk Labs, mm-hmm. which is its Google City operation, where the public officials in Toronto have proposed to give Google part of the waterfront to reinvent as the Google City. Okay. And what this does is it takes all of these methodologies that have been honed and tested mm-hmm. in these various ways that we've been discussing and now imposes them on populations where we should have democratic citizens who own and decide about the nature of their municipality. Mm-hmm. Instead, we get computational decision making for a greater good that aims people toward the most profitable outcomes of the owners of the systems.
So many of the questions, the couple more, are worried about, because this is the World Affairs Council, what people in foreign governments might do with this. And you just gave us an example of Toronto channeling us to serve essentially Google's profitable aims. But in China, these instruments of control, these Pokemon Go size experiments are being actively deployed. So how does that enter into this sort of surveillance capitalism? It's actually arguably being used in certain smart cities in China. And is it corporate or is it the government or is it corporate following the tune of the government? How do these things interact and how does a society take better control over being influenced in this hidden way that takes away agency?
Yes. Okay. So, So let's talk about this. Mm-hmm. Whoever asked the question earlier mm-hmm. about, couldn't this be a good thing? Yeah. Get people to vote. That sounds like a good thing. All right. So here's where you're down the slippery slope. Because when we talk about democracy, we have to talk about not just what is done, but how it is done. Getting a great outcome in an anti-democratic fashion is not good for democracy, mm-hmm. is not good for human freedom, and is not consistent with our elemental principles of morally autonomous individuals. Because at democracy, the idea of democracy requires, as its elements at the bottom of the system, the idea that we have citizens who are morally autonomous, who have agency, who can make choices, who have free will, who can consider things and take options, right? So this freedom is essential, an essential building block of democracy. At the top mm-hmm. of democracy, we have institutions that preserve a kind of equality across our society. Now, we're worried about economic inequality already, but here we're seeing institutions of surveillance capitalism already disfiguring our 21st century society with a pattern of extreme asymmetries of knowledge. Extreme asymmetries of knowledge that, with a little bit I've explained to you, hopefully allow you to see, also accrue to mm-hmm. extreme asymmetries of power, mm-hmm. right? To shape our behavior in ways that we have not chosen. I'm going to China.
Okay. All right.
I'm going to China, but this is sort of our backdrop. Mm-hmm. Now we go to China, mm-hmm. and guess what's different in China? There's no democracy in China. All right? So in China, it doesn't matter how you do it. In a democratic society, it matters how you do it. You can't just optimize energy efficiency in a democracy without that having been arrived at in a democratic way. That's why climate politics are so difficult. You go to China, you don't have to worry about how you do things because it's an authoritarian society. And in one way or another, it always has been. This is the signature of Chinese history, a very different culture, a very different history from our own and from that of Western democracies.
Okay, so when it comes to China, we're toast either way. But let's go to a different context. Let's pick Europe, a democracy. I mean, do you see something like the privacy regulations represented by the GDPR as a step in the direction of how society starts bringing back control over surveillance capitalism, or is it just throwing a penny at the problem?
All right. Well, I just want to say just to finish China for one tiny
please.
Tech.
Okay.
That in China, what we've got is an authoritarian state mm-hmm. looking over here and seeing what we thought were private companies, private sector companies within China, mm-hmm. like Tencent, Baidu, other companies, who have developed these immense capabilities of surveillance capitalism that I've just described to you, mm-hmm. and develop immense capabilities of instrumentarian power. So
learned
now you've
here.
Got an authoritarian state yeah. facing a society that is in many ways in chaos because of a long-term breakdown of social trust. And all of a sudden, this authoritarian state says, holy smokes, I don't want these private companies to have all these data and all this power to manipulate and shape behavior with these data. We want to do it. And we want to do it not to shape commercial outcomes. We want to do it to shape the societal outcomes and the political outcomes that we, as an authoritarian state, deem to be best for this society. Mm-hmm. That's the Chinese social credit system and the ways that it is being elaborated in that country. Mm-hmm. And that, in a way, is the apotheosis, the nightmare vision, mm-hmm. instrumentarian power, suffused, conflated with state power, that is not the place we want to go in our future.
Okay.
Right? So now we come to Europe.
Yep.
Europe and California are ahead of the pack with privacy law. And privacy law is extremely important. Europe has always been ahead in privacy law for many decades. The GDPR goes even further. But even as my political friends in Europe, most of them will agree that it goes further, it's fantastic, we need it, but when it comes to surveillance capitalism, it doesn't yet go far enough. Mm-hmm. Because we are going to need the kinds of laws that specifically interrupt and outlaw the mechanisms of surveillance capitalism.
Wow. So, but can we get the benefits of all this great technology if we don't have surveillance capitalism driving all these innovations?
What a powerful question. So glad you asked that question. Because what have we just been saying? Right? The big lie that has been perpetrated on us is that, folks, everything that Zuboff is describing to you is inevitable. This is the digital world, folks. Love it because you cannot leave it, right? This is inevitable. That is a big lie, friends. That is a big lie. What I've been saying is that I've described an economic logic, right? And an economic logic is not the same as technology. We can easily imagine digital technology without surveillance capitalism. It ain't that hard. It's impossible to imagine surveillance capitalism without the digital. Impossible.
Right.
Right? As we've understood with all the automated scale, scope, action, and so forth, instrumentarian power, all works through the means of the digital.
How did we just kind of just keep ignoring that over and over again? Because, I mean, you're describing a pretty terrifying circumstance that we just wandered by.
Yeah, well, part of it is what I've mentioned a couple of reasons.
Yeah.
I answer that question with 16 reasons in depth.
Okay.
All right, here we go. One. No, I'm not going to do that. Don't worry, I'm not going to do that.
give us three of them, because I think people...
I scared you, though. I scared you for a minute.
Give us three.
I'm going to give you three.
Okay.
Three's a perfect number.
Okay, great, okay. Always.
Number one, I've already explained this, unprecedented. When something is unprecedented, by nature, you literally can't recognize it. You can't cognize it. That's why we think instrumentarian power is totalitarian power. And when totalitarian power first broke on the world, nobody got that either, and they thought it was a version of imperialism. And it took a whole generation of scholars to say, this is a new kind of power, and explain it. All right, so unprecedented. Number two, I've already told you, engineered for ignorance.
Okay.
Engineered to bypass our awareness. When we tell people about this stuff, they really don't want to do it. They really don't want any part about it. Okay, and number three is... the great philosopher Roberto Unger calls the dictatorship of no alternatives, right? So we've gotten to a point in our lives, Jim, where routine social participation, you know, I want to organize dinner tonight with friends and family. I want to get my kids' grades from their school. I want to get my health test results from my doctor's office. Mm-hmm. Any simple thing that we do marches us through surveillance capitalism's supply chains. All of these things, every product with the word smart in front of it, every service with the word personalized in front of it, folks, remember this. These are just interfaces for these supply chains. Personalization is the opposite of privacy. It means it's all gone. You know, we've put people in an impossible position.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that I consider intolerable, that 21st century citizens, because of surveillance capitalism, now have to make a choice between effective social participation mm-hmm. and being tainted and being engulfed at every step by these systems from which increasingly there is no escape. This is intolerable. This is not okay. Thank you.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Shoshana Zuboff. She's professor at Harvard Business School and the author of a new book entitled Surveillance Capitalism, The Fight for a Human Future at the New Frontier of Power. The program was moderated by Jim Fruchterman. He's founder and CEO of Tech Matters. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Radio and the Aspen Institute. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. Our researcher is Claire McMahon. Our producer is Jared Sport. And our executive producer is Laura Beatty. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.